Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast, and we're pleased to be joined today by Father George Coyne, the president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation, who is visiting America House from Arizona. Welcome, Father Coyne.
Nice to be with you, Tim. I always enjoy coming here to Manhattan.
Now, maybe you can, your role now is the president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation, but for many years you served at the observatory itself. Maybe you can describe the observatory to people who may not be familiar with it.
Well, the Vatican Observatory dates back in its, its original foreshadowings to 1582, which is the time of the reform of the calendar. But the observatory was formally founded in 1891 and then in 1935. So the sort of historical headlines of it. In 1935, the observatory was moved to Castel Gandolfo when Pius XI went there for the first pope to use Castel Gandolfo as his summer residence. And then in the 1970s, it became clear, like it does to many observatories, that the sky was too bright. We could no longer observe the faintest objects from Castel Gandolfo, which is just 20, 25 miles south of Rome. So at that time, and the director just previous to me already realized this problem and began to examine various possibilities. When I became director in 1978, we again explored both the possibilities that we had, and we opened it up to a wider investigation. In the end, with great support from Pope John Paul II, we opened a research institute in Tucson, Arizona. And it's very clear to say that our headquarters still remain at Castel Gandolfo, that this is a research institute, kind of a subsidiary of the headquarters. And that research is done at both centers. That is, Castel Gandolfo is not just an administrative center, because for two reasons, there are many, but for two principal reasons. We have a very valuable meteorite collection at Castel Gandolfo, and Brother Guy Consolmagno on our staff is trained in that area and has an excellent laboratory. So research in that area, which is very important because it tells us about the early solar system. In fact, much of that material tells us about the formation of the sun. It dates back before the sun. The other area is that when we observe with these modern telescopes in Tucson, Arizona, we can store our data on a disk or however we want to store it, take it back to Castel Gandolfo. All you need is a computer. So a lot of our data reduction of our observations done in Tucson. I'm saying that because these two centers are very much related to one another. And in fact, so much so that after many years of being two communities, two separate communities, we're now one Jesuit community with one superior. It's a tough job for a superior to have two communities separated by, 8,000 miles?
Now, have the Jesuits been involved with the observatory for a long time?
For a long time, since 1906.
Okay.
However, it's not a Jesuit institution. It's a Vatican observatory staffed by the Jesuits.
Now, I think some people would be surprised, perhaps, who are not familiar with the observatory, that this has been around so long, especially given, at least in the popular press, the portrayal of the Church's relationship with science. So here's an example where the Church is actively involved in scientific observation research. Why astronomy? Why this particular field?
It just happened. It happened because the beginnings of the observatory were associated with the reform of the calendar. The calendar in 1582 was reformed because 10 days had to be taken out of the calendar to pull it back in place, because spring was falling back into winter, and feasts like the Resurrection of the Lord, the Passover, etc., were becoming winter festivals, and thereby their symbolism. So it became astronomy because astronomers, the Jesuit astronomers at the Roman College in downtown Rome, were the ones called upon by the Pope to study the data to reform the calendar, because a calendar reform is very complicated. It's not just numerology. It's a lot of very complicated work, observations, data analysis. And so astronomy became, by tradition, by that early tradition, and then following upon the success of the reform of the calendar, subsequent popes founded papal observatories. There was an observatory on the Capitoline Hill in what is now the center of modern Rome, overlooks the Forum. There was an observatory on the top of the Church of St. Ignatius right in downtown Rome. So a tradition started until in 1891, Leo XIII formally founded what we call the modern observatory, the Specula Vaticana, the Vatican Observatory. And it's interesting from what you just indicated, Tim, is that with all the struggles of the church, with Galileo, even today, the vast debates that are going on, science and the culture of religious belief and all that, Leo XIII said in his founding document in 1891 that he wanted to show that far from the church being opposed to true and certain scientific pursuits, he was founding the observatory to have a visible sign of religious priests who were both dedicated to the church as religious believers, but also trained scientists. Nowadays, I think we modern Jesuits don't make a great deal of that. We simply do our work. And if it shines before the world, that's fine. If it becomes that kind of symbol of the concord between science and religion, that's fine. But to be honest with it, we're not out front kind of preaching that. We're doing our science.
Now, what first drew you to the study of astronomy? Were you studying to be a Jesuit when you first started upon this field of research?
Yes, because I became a Jesuit when I was 18 years old. I mean, in those days, it was rather common to enter right from high school. And I went to a Jesuit high school, Loyola High School, Blakefield in Baltimore. And I would say my motivation was hero worship. It wasn't astronomy. I had 13 young Jesuit, the Jesuit scholastics teaching us, and their kind of lives just impressed many of us. And I felt a vocation through that. It was only as a Jesuit then, and fairly much later on, that my interest in astronomy developed. And it developed through a professor of Greek and Latin literature, believe it or not. The happenstances of life.
And as you say, you folks are involved in your actual day-to-day research. You're not looking to make broad statements about science and religion, yet you're often pointed to as an example of the ways the church can be involved in scientific work. Do you think that the work that you do can have ramifications for the larger debate about science and religion, and especially these days when there's a lot of, you know, the new atheist people who are really saying that religion and science are incompatible?
No, it definitely has an impact. I mean, our science, the fact that we publish in international journals, we do our science like any other scientist does. We attend congresses, we exchange, our science in an international community of astronomers, etc. That definitely has an impact. My point, however, is, and I always claim this, and the new director is very, very, very strong on kind of preaching this line, that our contribution to the science-religion dialogue is unique in the sense that we are scientists. We're not just philosophers and theologians. I'm not downplaying, you know, the impact that philosophy and theology have upon this debate. But our unique contribution can be to do good science so that when we come to this debate, we really know what we're talking about when we talk from a scientific perspective. But we also have, as Jesuits, a degree of training in philosophy and theology. So to my mind, it's rather a unique combination. There are not that many who enter this dialogue who have both training in the sciences and a degree of a philosophical theological culture. So we have to do good science in order to really contribute to this dialogue.
Now, you mentioned the work of Brother Guy Consolmagno and his research into meteorites. What other kind of work do you do, and is there a special kind of niche you've carved out within the world of astronomy?
Well, as a background, I would say that each of us Jesuits, by the way, there are 14 of us, if I'm counting correctly, on the staff now, and of those, at least 10 are scientists or involved in the history and philosophy of science. So with that as background, each one of the Jesuits on our staff really has his own field of research because of the previous training that they have. So we study stars. Father Chris Corbelly is involved in a very special type of stellar population. Father Boyle is currently using techniques to look for extraterrestrial planets, that is, planets that are about other stars. Brother Guy, as we mentioned, is a planetary scientist, so he's involved in studying planetary systems, which includes examination of meteorites, asteroids, the planets in our own solar system, etc. Father Bill Steger is a theoretical, I would say he's a cosmologist. He studied general relativity and cosmology. I myself, my early work was a study of the chemistry of the lunar surface, but I've since then turned into using a very special technique to study binary stars, where these two stars, one of them is actually so dense, it has such a large gravity field that it's sucking matter off the other star, and this creates a very interesting system, since we estimate at least 30% of the stars in the universe, and there are a lot of them, are double stars or multiple stars. So, and another very interesting field of research is, since our telescope in Arizona is one of the world's best telescopes for imaging. It's not the largest by any means, but because of sophisticated optics, it's very, very suited to doing imaging. So there's a whole program, and the current director, Father Funes, is very much involved in it when he can be because of administrative responsibilities, in examining nearby galaxies, because they're older galaxies, to compare them to very distant galaxies that Hubble sees, to see how galaxies age. And it's very interesting to understand now, the further out in space we look, the further back we're looking in time, right? Because light travels at a finite speed. So I don't see you sitting here as you are, but as you were a millisecond ago. I see the sun when it sets as it was 8 minutes ago. So with a big telescope, we look very far out. We're seeing galaxies as they were, let's say, 12 billion years ago. So we can, as we look at different distances, see galaxies of different ages in the expanding universe. And our telescope helps us to make very careful comparisons of nearby galaxies, which are older galaxies from what I said, to these other more distant younger galaxies. And that's very important because galaxies are the building blocks of the universe.
Sure. So. Now, you mentioned why the church got involved in this research at the beginning, but you also noted that John Paul was a big supporter of your work. What are the current popes? Why do they think this is important work?
They think it's important work because of the contribution it makes to the insertion of the church in modern culture. I think there's no doubt about it that modern culture is very heavily scientific. You don't have to be a scientist, but you cannot live without getting somewhat involved in trying to inform yourself about space research, about research on meteorites, let's say, all of the revolutions in biological research, discussions about a biological, physical, chemical evolution, all of that. The church feels that to be inserted into that through having some institute that's involved strictly in scientific research is very important. So the popes have all supported this. The modern popes have all supported it.
Does that argue for the church being involved, I know these aren't yours, but in other scientific worlds like, you know, molecular biology or right. Just because there's a lot of debate these days, for example, about stem cell research, and perhaps the church would have more credibility if there were actually scientists involved in this field?
Yeah. The church can only do so much, though.
Yeah, right? Right, of course.
And the church as such is not a scientific institute. The reason it sponsors the Vatican Observatory, we've talked about, it's simply because of a long tradition in history. And since we continue to do good work, the popes want to continue that tradition. But not to found an institute for research in molecular biology or so. The church can only do so much. However, through the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which is an academy, so it's not a research institute as such. It sponsors research. It sponsors meetings on very important topics in science. But through the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, the church is at least makes a serious attempt to be inserted into all important areas of modern science, including, you know, those areas that contribute to very important moral and ethical and doctrinal issues.
Finally, maybe we can end with a book that's getting a lot of attention in this country, which is Stephen Hawking's new book, The Grand Design, and specifically his statement that the creation of the universe does not require, I'm quoting him here, the intervention of some supernatural being or God. Now, if you had to discuss or debate Dr. Hawking on these questions, how would you respond to that?
Well, I have debated Dr. Hawking on these questions in the past, more or less privately, not in a public forum. It's nothing new. I mean, his previous writings in this area, this is a continuation of the same with some modern science added on. That is quantum cosmology, and he's an expert in these areas of quantum cosmology, etc. The problem is there's a confusion in the use of language in the area of philosophy and theology and science. So if the theory that the universe began from a quantum nothing, a fluctuation, and what is said to be a nothing in a scientific sense, but in a philosophical sense, it's something because it has fluctuations. The two important ingredients of that scientific theory are the notion of a quantum nothing and the idea of not having initial boundary conditions. That is, there were no initial conditions set on the universe. It just came to be from this quantum fluctuation. Well, that may be true, and it may not be true in a scientific sense, but whether it, let's accept that it's true, that does not in any way conflict with the philosophical and theological notion of God created the universe out of nothing. Because God's creation of the universe out of nothing is a theological built upon a philosophical approach to reality. And what it's really saying, regardless of how the universe began, it totally depends upon God, because the universe is contingent. It's not, they're philosophical concepts. The universe does not exist by necessity in the philosophical sense. And if it does, to make sense philosophically of the existence of the universe, you have to say there's a necessary eternal being upon whom the universe depends. So there's not a conflict between those two notions if one understands that they are different areas of human pursuit, of human knowledge. The problem with many of, and I may sound accusatory, and I'll just accept the fact that I do, is that many of the so-called new atheists, the modern atheist, and let's put from his recent writings, Stephen Hawking into this, do not see that human culture is much wider than science. I mean, science is magnificent. I love doing science, and it's very powerful in human culture. But I like music, I like art, I like certain literature, some poetry I like, some I don't like, some people I like, some people I don't like. I mean, human experience is so broad that why establish conflicts between one area of human experience and the other when the conflict really doesn't exist if you accept the totality of human experience? You don't have to be a religious believer. But not to appreciate that religious faith is a part of human culture is simply to, you know, is to turn yourself blind to a whole area of, even if you're an atheist, you have to accept that the world is not totally atheistic. So you have to deal with the fact that that's a part of human culture. So very briefly, I think the problem arises because of the inability to accept that human experience is very rich in many areas.
Well, that's very helpful, and I think you've given us a lot to think about. So we want to thank Father George Coyne, again, the president of the Vatican Observatory Foundation, for stopping by.
Good, Tim. It's good to be with you. Thanks for allowing me to share.
I want to thank you again for joining us for the American Magazine podcast and encourage you to look online where we have a video report from Kevin Clark, who just returned from Israel, on the plight of Palestinians in that country. We also have a culture piece from John Sweeney looking at the tradition of animal blessings and its roots in the Jewish tradition. A reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.